This is WGNS Action Line. Action Line. Talking with Rutherford County newsmakers for 78 years. Talking with Rutherford County newsmakers for 78 years. This is WGNS Action Line. Now, your host, Scott Walker.
In studio with us, we have Murfreesboro Fire and Rescue Chief Mark McCluskey. So what have we seen over the last few days?
Well, we've had a lot of rain in the area, but as far as flooding, this time we didn't really get too much. It was more north of us, so was kind of lucky, dodged the bullet here.
Whenever we have all of this rain, and rain like they've seen in Lebanon and Sumner County, those areas got hit really hard.
They did. Some of them, I believe, received up to about 12 inches of rain.
Whenever we get rain like that, how quickly do the banks of the river, the creeks, and all that overflow? How long does that usually take?
It doesn't take too long, depending, you know, how the rain comes down. If it comes down really hard for a good while, they'll come up pretty quick in an hour to where they're up and to their banks of not getting out of the banks.
Do you sometimes have to go to some of these other counties when storms like this hit?
Yes, we do. We, of course, we're always going to make sure we're okay here before we deploy any teams out. Actually, right now, we're still on standby for the state. We've got a team on standby. We have not been utilized yet to be deployed anywhere.
And do you already know ahead of time, all right, well, if this happens in this area, well, we're signed up to help in that county or that city? Do you have certain cities you're assigned to ahead of time?
If it's through TEMA, which is headed up by the Tennessee Fire Chiefs Association, far as deploying teams to different counties, it's basically the whole state. We can go anywhere. Now, if it's here locally, we'll stay close to our counties. And if, you know, West Tennessee, will use resources from that area, from West Tennessee, so far, you know, like East Tennessee also.
So if it's within an hour or so, do you, you know, the fire crews that are helping out, do they have to spend the night there or do they come back home? What do they do?
Typically, if we get deployed, it's usually, depending on the situation, we're going to be gone for at least a week. We can guarantee them that. Then we'll start swapping our teams out if needed. Typically on flooding like this, after the rain has gone away, 2 to 3 days will normally get what you need to get done as far as any rescues and stuff like that.
And then those firemen who are going, they actually, what, volunteer to say, hey, I'll do this, I'll go?
Yes. Now, we have several people on our water rescue team that it's deployable to go out. Of course, there's certain guidelines they got to meet, and most of all of our people do. We'll send out an email asking for volunteers who wants to go. And we'll build a team from those names.
Something that we're hearing more and more about, especially in some of these smaller communities out there that are maybe starting their first fire department, but we're hearing more and more about firemen who work full-time at one department, but then they're going to work part-time at another department in a nearby city.
We do have that. Some departments don't have the funding, the smaller departments, to maybe have a full-time fire department, so they'll hire part-time. I think we still have a few that may do it in their hometowns. They'll work here full-time, and on their 2 days off, they'll work part-time at one of their local departments.
And when they, I guess, work part-time in those other areas, they don't, well, from what I understand, they don't usually spend the night at those departments. It usually is like an 8 to 12-hour work day.
Yeah, normally an 8 to 12-hour day.
Are we needing that here in Murfreesboro? Do we need part-time firefighters here?
No, sir. Of course, we're a fully paid department. We're fully staffed right now, so we have adequate manpower, all full-time employees.
Going back to storms, when storms do come in, the work that you do during these storms is not necessarily out of the norm. I guess it's just a whole lot more of it all at once.
That is correct. You know, the water comes up. It catches some people by surprise. You have some people, you know, kayak and drill big. It's like the water's up and rough. Let's go kayaking in this. But we do still have water rescues throughout the year that may not be weather related, far as people out doing recreational things, or you never know how it's going to strand them.
So you actually have people who go out kayaking, canoeing, rafting even, whenever the water is at floodwater level?
We have had that, yes.
Doesn't seem very smart.
Yeah, well, it's not. During flooding like this, you never know what's in the water, what's washed out, logs, fences, and stuff like that.
I guess when you look at the river, you think to yourself, oh, it's just like the Ocoee River. It looks just as fun. But the reality of it is it's nothing like the Ocoee at that time, because the Ocoee doesn't have stuff floating through it that comes from floods, and that's what we have when the water gets high here.
That is correct. You know, the Ocoee, even though it is swift water, it's kind of controlled to where floodwaters are not controlled at all.
It's wild how they can shut that thing down at night, and
it
doesn't even look like the same river.
As a matter of fact, that's where we do some of our swift water training.
That'd be kind of fun, but kind of scary too.
Yes, I can remember when I went through it, we were standing there, and here comes people coming through these rapids on kayaks and stuff, and I'm about to jump in with nothing other than my life jacket.
Yeah, you ever think to yourself, what am I doing here?
Yeah, what am I doing? And I got to swim across the river and back across. You know, I had to do it like, I think it was 7 or 8 times, you know.
And when water is flowing as fast as it does, like on the Ocoee, or when floodwater comes here to Rutherford County and Stones River, but when it's flowing that fast, how hard is it, even if it's 2 feet, 3 feet deep, how hard is it to get across or to get to the middle?
Virtually impossible. The pressure of the water, I'm not exactly sure, but I'm thinking it's about 30 pounds per square inch on your body for every mile an hour of water. So it's going to wash your feet off from you for sure.
That's a lot of weight when you look at a square inch, the size of a square inch. That's a lot of weight pushing you.
It is.
When you have to be called to the scene of somewhere where somebody does need rescuing, is it always a case where they're in flood water that's moving rapidly, or sometimes are they in still water?
Yeah, it's sometimes it is rapid. Majority of the times around here, it's just the stagnant water. Maybe we're an area like we just had the last rainstorm we come through down on West College at the railroad crossings. That water was up 2 to 3 feet through there. So the car went in and of course, drowned the motor out, and they were stranded out in the water.
In those types of situations where the water is not rapidly flowing or anything, why don't people just walk out of there? I mean, I'm assuming they first call either 911 or the non-emergency line and say, hey, here's where we are, here's the problem. And then dispatch says, what, stay still? Or what are they?
Yeah, if they're okay in the car and the car's not floating off, you never know with flood waters what's going on underneath. The road could be washed out. Who knows what's up under there? So the safest way to get them out is just to take a boat, go out to them, put them in the boat, and bring them back to shore.
Okay.
So that's the safest way. Not saying that you could not walk, but it's the safest way is through the boat.
And then I guess you have to call a wrecker service to pull their vehicle out of there?
Yes, and that'll be left up to them how they want to get it out. Sometimes we'll wait till the water goes down so they don't have to go out in the water themselves, you know. Then we turn another situation on the same call.
I wonder how insurance looks at that. When you drive through something where you're obviously seeing water, why would you drive through it? But what does insurance say even?
You know, I'm not real sure on that, but you know, I'm sure they do pay, because insurance will pay for making mistakes.
And of course, summer's coming up, so I'm sure you got to get those calls, you know, that some of the boat launch ramps that are in the Murfreesboro area where people are backing maybe a small fishing boat into the water, into the river, and then next thing you know, they don't put the emergency brake on and whole car goes right in.
We've had those. A lot of times what we have, it's the rescues we have with people will be, it got dark on them, they don't know where they're at, know how to get back. We've had calls where people just get exhausted, unable to get back, fight the stream back up to their vehicle, have to go get them. And we have had emergency medical issues while somebody's out, maybe get hurt or have a medical emergency and have to go after them too.
Now, I've seen some of the creeks in our area, and when they flood, it doesn't look recognizable. I mean, it looks like a totally different creek, of course. A creek that's normally ankle deep in some spots or a foot deep is all of a sudden 5 feet, 6 feet deep in certain areas. How dangerous are those?
They're very dangerous. It could look like it's still water on the top and could be draining from the bottom into a drain. Unfortunately, we had one of these issues last year, losing one of our citizens here in town. When a young man got washed into a drain like that.
And so these drains, the drainage systems, I guess, in certain neighborhoods, some are a little bit newer than others, but the overall problem is what? Is it the actual front that's on the actual drainage pipe that goes in? Is it too large? Is the opening too big? What is it that's so dangerous there?
The issue is some have covers over them to keep debris and stuff from going into them. But you'll have flood water, and on top, everybody thinks, oh, if it's a funnel with the water going down, that's dangerous. But that can be going on underneath that you don't see on top, and people get in that water and get in that vortex and get sucked into the drain.
And so if the pressure is hard enough, if the water's flowing fast enough, they can get sucked in and just held there underwater, but not necessarily go into the drain?
That is correct.
Okay. I never even really thought about that. But is it powerful enough to, I guess, suck your leg in there? Because
oh, yes, most definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, just even in our training on the koi, like we was talking about earlier, there are certain parts where you can get into that undertow that has that effect on you.
The average person doesn't think a lot about undertow. They don't think a lot about rip tides or things that you normally would see in the ocean here in rivers and creeks. So what do we see here locally?
Well, normally we just have your everyday streams, normal heights, good time to get out there and float on them, not much danger. But when you add all that extra water, the velocity of the water, the speed of it, and out of the banks like we were talking about, it becomes very dangerous. You have no control.
We also have some small dams along Stones River. Those small dams where you normally don't see water flowing over them, you do whenever these floodwaters come. And then I'm assuming you can get trapped kind of underneath the dam as that water's coming down.
Very same thing I was talking about. You got some low head dams. When the water gets up, you cannot see the dam, but that turbulence is still going on underneath it.
At one point, I know in the state of Tennessee, they were trying to outlaw or change laws to where certain, was it the low head dams, would not be allowed in rivers and creeks, and I don't know if anything was ever changed or accomplished there.
I don't recall anything on that. I'm not sure where that went.
How dangerous are those little dams? Because you do see them behind some neighborhoods where you have creeks or rivers going through the neighborhood. How dangerous are those?
Well, we don't typically have many calls just because of the low head dam like that. Now, we have had issues, some of them that are kind of high, not knowing getting up on the dam and jumping off to the other side, not knowing how deep that water is and causing injury to them. Typically, they're not much trouble, you know, unless you have a lot of water flowing over them. People get on them, they're flowing, their feet wash out from under them. The next thing you know, they're either injured or going downstream injured.
Again, with us today, we have Murfreesboro Fire Rescue Chief Mark McCluskey. So have numbers overall been up as far as calls go for the city of Murfreesboro?
They have been. We've been running around 1,850, 1,900 calls a month. The month of March, we went a little bit over 2,000, so they continuously go up each month.
How does that compare to other nearby cities like Franklin and Brentwood, Mount Juliet, Lebanon? How does that compare?
As far as per capita and stations that we have, we're a little bit higher for what all we do compared to some stations you have. Some may not run as many medical calls we do, but it's pretty much average. You know, if you figure it out with Nashville's, of course, they run so many more calls, but they got so many more stations in their population. So if you compare it like that, we're just as busy as them, just not as much going on at one time. But yeah, it's continuously going up with all the services we offer and provide to our citizens. We're needed every day for something.
Now, is there currently a need to hire more firemen in Murfreesboro?
Right now, we're in good shape. In our budget this year, we have asked for a couple of three positions that are administrative, not necessarily men and women on the street, but administrative positions. We're looking at building two new stations in the near future. In the next 4 to 5 years, probably have two new stations online. And, of course, when they come online, we'll have to hire staffing for those two stations.
And then when you look at paramedics and you look at medical-type emergency calls, how does that impact the Murfreesboro Fire and Rescue Department? Do you have paramedics on every truck? What do you do?
Right now, we have right at 30 paramedics in our department. Typically, they're spread out, different stations, but normally we always have a paramedic on scene, especially now we do have paramedics that is our safety officer. If it's a serious scene, he runs on every medical call that could be a medic needed on that call, and they'll run on that call. But typically, we usually have a paramedic on scene.
And then you're assuming you get to the scene first, you're also waiting for an ambulance to show up too. I mean, if it is something that needs an ambulance, so you're going to have additional medical help within maybe a couple of minutes.
That is correct. We work under the same protocols as Rutherford County EMS. They provide EMS service for the whole county, which the city is in the county. And the fire department provides EMS service for the city in addition to the EMS coming. So we normally, depending on the situation, what's going on, arrive first. We start our patient care. Then when EMS gets there, they can assist and take over and transport the patient.
Now, is there a chance that in the near future that Murfreesboro Fire and Rescue could also have their own ambulances?
It's a possibility. It was something brought up a few years ago that didn't go. But, you know, you never know what the future is going to hold, how it's going to work best. We don't want to duplicate services as far as us getting ambulances here, and the county doesn't need them in the city or whatnot. You know, that will go to the higher powers to decide that, because it's going to be a financial decision made when you do that.
I was about to say, because when you take on that additional service of having ambulances, you're also talking about having to set up a billing system, because you're billing patients who are given rides to and from the hospital. I mean, there is a lot that goes into that.
It's a whole lot. You know, there's a lot of involvement with the state coming in here and regulating it. One thing I look at, too, is Rutherford County EMS provides services for the whole county. Well, the majority of their revenues and calls are in the city of Murfreesboro. So if we just come in and took that over, that would have a tremendous effect on the way their personnel operates and their budget and everything with the county.
There's a lot that goes into emergency work in general, and you almost have to work with every single department, really meet with them almost weekly, I would imagine, because there are so many things that do happen, and there's so many different needs that are being created right now.
That is correct. And, you know, communication is the main key. We reach out to each other and talk and discuss issues and how we can make it better and what works best for us, work best for them, and try to work together on it.
A couple of years ago, we saw some real peaks when it comes to overdose cases, and it seemed like there were just a ton of growing number of overdoses because of drug use. Is that number still growing, or does it seem like on your end, are you still seeing an increase in the number of calls involving overdoses?
It's I don't think it's really increasing anymore, but it's staying steady. The numbers are pretty much staying the same on what we're having, and from day to day you'll have a spike in them. And it's sad to say, if a bad batch of dope comes through, then we have a lot of overdoses on the same day or 2 or 3 days in a row to that batch is gone. But it's an everyday occurrence now. And we also, of course, we have Narcan. EMS has Narcan. The police department has Narcan now. And you've maybe seen on the news here lately in Nashville, they're having little, like, AEDs you have hanging up. They got Narcan where a person could use them, just the public could use them on somebody.
It is very, very sad, but it's very interesting to watch how the different police departments, fire departments, etc., around the state figure out new ways to respond to these growing problems. Because I would say in the past, probably just a couple of years ago, I would have called it an epidemic, but it does seem like things are starting to get a little bit better. But then you do have the problem of more and more fentanyl being sold, and people are believing, I guess they're buying one thing, but they're actually getting fentanyl.
Yes. I don't know, when you say that you think they're getting better, I don't know if the problem is getting better. The of us taking care of the problem has gotten better. Like I said, it's still an everyday occurrence. But yeah, the fentanyl is where it's coming from. To be blunt, it's kind of like somebody wants to have a better drug than the other drug dealer, and they're putting fentanyl in them, and they have no method of doing this. If you get it wrong or don't mix it right, that's where your overdoses are coming from.
It's scary, and especially scary if you have kids today.
Oh, yes. Just reality, you know, with marijuana, people don't think of it as being a drug that you overdose on, but it is now. People put fentanyl in marijuana, and it happens, and there's different ways.
I had no idea. So people are putting fentanyl even in marijuana.
Yes. I've been to some, it's actually hazmat classes, but we go into making some different things, drugs, to show you the explosive part of it and the hazards of it. And some of the things they do to marijuana nowadays, it's unbelievable.
Then on top of that, you have synthetic marijuana that's really nothing like the real deal of marijuana that used to grow. It's synthetic, homemade, sometimes made in a lab, fake marijuana.
Yes, we did have a run of that at one time. I hadn't heard much on that here lately. You know, they kind of cracked down on it, what they were selling in the stores, because they were selling just over the counter.
Yeah, and bath salts too. I remember you could buy that stuff anywhere.
And I can remember stopping in stores myself, you know, maybe to grab a Coke and see it at the counter. It's like, what is that stuff? You know, it didn't take me long to figure out what it was by the calls we started getting on it.
It makes you want to just say to the store owner, what are you thinking?
Yeah.
You know, how is this going to benefit you?
You know, I think some of the store owners didn't really know what they had. It's like, oh, I can make some good money off selling this stuff. And that's what they may have been looking at. But it didn't take long. We started finding out, the public started finding out what this stuff was. You know, that was back when I was on the truck and made some medical calls with this stuff. It was kind of unbelievable what it would do to some of the kids.
When you respond to a call where there is some type of drug overdose or a problem with drugs, maybe even synthetic marijuana, but when you respond and you get to the house and there's a 12-year-old who is using this drug, was that a sight that was uncommon?
It wasn't too uncommon, maybe a little bit older than that. And when you do make these calls, you know by your training they have something in them that's causing them to act the way they are. And they want to deny it the first thing. And it's like, because they have this mentality, it's like, oh, if I tell them I did this, I'm going to be in trouble and go to jail. So I'm going to act like I'm just sick or something's going on. But later on down the line, when you start working with them and talking with the parents, it's, you know, it's not about me trying to get you in trouble. I need to know what you've done so I can help you. And it generally works out.
The way a kid's mind thinks, their first thought is, mom, dad's going to get furious with me. I can't tell him really what I'm doing. But if they would just slow down, and maybe once they're able to talk to you and have a better understanding, maybe they will open up more.
Yeah, and in a lot of occasions, you know, their mind's so altered, you don't know what's going on, and neither do they.
I bet parents are scared to death when that happens.
Yeah, going back to the synthetic drugs, from what I understand how it would work, it would give you that high, then it would make people think, oh, if I do more, I'll get twice as high, so to speak. But there was a limit to your body could take, and once you got over that limit, it threw you into season, just all kinds of, season was the main thing. And it was hard to treat those patients when it was like that.
When you have crews at the scene of something where maybe a kid, maybe a teenager has overdosed on drugs, and you have a parent who was maybe even doing drugs with their kid, because that does happen too, how is that being in the middle of that mix where you also have policemen there trying to determine what actually happened, what went wrong?
Well, you know, if we do have a situation like that, like you said, the police department's going to be there. Our main objective here is to take care of the patient. Any kind of wrongdoing with that, we let the police department handle that. Now, we have had situations to where maybe before the police department get there, we'll have to kind of separate or just do what we need to do to keep the peace until they get there.
When you're the first one there and you got somebody who is dying and in some serious problem going on, do you have to physically move or remove some people out of a house sometimes?
We've had that. Here's the thing about it. You never know how a person's going to react when they see their loved one laying on the floor, possibly dying or going to die or have died. So you treat each one different. You know, a lot of it's anxiety, just not knowing what they need to do or don't know what they're doing. You just try to get them out of that atmosphere and talk to them there. We go through training when we go to our medical school to deal with this stuff. Everybody acts different. I can remember a call that the outcome was not good, but talking to the husband, that was the best thing that I could do at the time. I took him outside and come to find out that he was in the military, and he was actually a paramedic in military. And he knew what was going on, and he just wanted to talk to me about it, something other than what was really going on. And it was his wife. You never know how people are going to react.
It's scary to be there, and then for your guys who are seeing this type of stuff probably on a daily basis or at least every shift, how do they cope with it?
There's several different ways. Of course, we have things in place for them to get counseling, talk to people, which sometimes we never know. Sometimes it affects them. It's like putting drops in a bucket, so we speak about it. Finally, the bucket gets full and overflows, and they got to have some help. And we've had firemen that way. We're always there for them. Like I said, we got things in our toolbox to help them out several different ways. We have a crisis team. We have a chaplain service. We have a lot of things in place for them. You go years seeing people's like, you know, like in the old days, oh, he's tough. You know, he's never, you know, none of this stuff never bothers him. Eventually it does. They get help. Some people, I've seen them go ahead and retire because of it. Everybody handles that different too.
Again, Fire Chief Mark McCluskey with us with Murfreesboro Fire and Rescue. And when a fireman decides, I do need some help, you know, this is tough to see every day. Everybody who's there at their department, do they know about them going to get help?
For the most part, no. Some people do have to know because there's the paperwork and stuff you have to fill out. So there's some people going to know. But it's not hard to figure out if it's somebody from your station, normally, if they got to go help. But our men and women are pretty tight at their stations. If they're having issues, those other guys and women know that this person's having an issue, and they want to help them too, and they're glad to see them go. Now, as far as, we don't come out and say, oh, so-and-so's having to go to psychiatrist to get help. We don't do
it's
that.
Like,
but
that's what the hospital doesn't do either, you know?
Yeah, exactly. There's HIPAA laws in place. But we got a good program. There's people that you know that you can talk to. You know which person to go to get help if you need it. And it stays anonymous about everything until maybe you bring it out yourself, because sometimes that's the best way to help is talking to your coworkers, depending on the severity of the case.
We got to take a short break. Fire Chief Mark McCluskey with us this morning. And when we come back, I know I've read a lot of articles recently talking about how, when compared to even 5 to 10 years ago, life-saving methods and the way that CPR has changed is really changing the outcome for a lot of patients, to where they're living. They're not, some were brain dead, I guess, if CPR wasn't done in time. But things are really changing there. So can we learn maybe more about that?
Yeah, sure.
This is WGNS Action Line. Action Line. Talking with Rutherford County newsmakers for 78 years. Celebrating 78 years of being your good neighbor station.
Holden Hardware now has an e-commerce site. Go to doitbest.com/Holden-Hardware and shop all the items in our warehouse. You can have them shipped directly to you, or most items can be shipped for free to Holden Hardware for pickup. Shop with us in person or go online to doitbest.com/Holden-Hardware.
One more time.
doitbest.com/Holden-Hardware.
This is Peter Demas, and our family is inviting your family to come eat with us at Demas's Restaurant. The salmon is my favorite, and then we have a variation that's on a regular menu for the salmon imperial that has some Alfredo, some crab, some shrimp on it. But the salmon is fresh, and we cut it fresh. But all of our fish, you can either get blackened, or you can get it with our regular seasoned salt. And either way you do it, it's just out of this world. I'm not a fish person, but I will eat it at Demas's all the time. Come eat with us at Demas's Restaurant on Northwest Broad Street.
Talking with Rutherford County newsmakers about what matters most to you. This is a WGNS Action Line with Scott Walker.
With us today in studio, we have from Murfreesboro Fire and Rescue, Fire Chief Mark McCluskey. And before that last break, we mentioned how a lot of folks are really doing well after receiving CPR, whereas that wasn't always the case. I mean, things have changed even in the way we do CPR.
They have. Looking back over the years, ever since I've been at the fire department, we've always had to know CPR. And thinking back to our first days of going and getting certified, and it was through the Red Cross at that time, you know, the compressions we were given and the amount of breaths, still basically same, just some of it's changed up a little bit. But from going from that to where you didn't even have a BVM, which is where you give the breaths, you did it manually. We got little protective things with plastic. Used to, it was just mouth on mouth. You know, wow. That's the way it was years ago. You didn't have all these diseases you thought about. Well, now, of course, nobody's bare mouth even touched. It's all done manually with bags.
Have you guys got that Lucas device?
We do. I was going to get into that. It was one of the new technologies. After that, we had AEDs come in, external defibrillator. That was a game changer. We didn't have anything like that in the field. Then now we got the Lucas device. We just put those on all of our frontline equipment last year. And that's a game changer also, because given chest compressions, it's very extreme hard work to do it and do it consistent to make sure that you're getting the compressions right. The Lucas device takes all that out of guessing. You put it on their chest, set it up, takes less than 30 seconds to get it going and hit start, and it gives continuous, accurate, and good chest compressions, which obviously is better for somebody in cardiac arrest.
Now, what I read about that was really the most interesting part of it, because I don't think the average person thinks about this stuff, but the number of cases of people who have brain damage after they're unconscious, CPR is performed in the years past, was pretty high. That's no longer really... Well, it's not the case for most situations like it used to be.
Well, yeah, it's a lot of factors in that. The brain is going to start dying off after 5 to 6 minutes. Now, with 911 taking the call getting it dispatched and having a fast response time, that's key to it, than having good, accurate CPR. It's really getting there fast and doing it and starting it, having a whole lot better outcomes on them. And I have noticed several years back, we'd do CPR and never would have anybody come back and say, oh, yeah, I saved their life, CPR. It was giving them a chance. That percentage now is a lot higher. I have actually seen people walk in the stations. We've done stories on it before. It's like, y'all saved my life. You know, I was dead.
Yeah.
You brought me back. They bring in their family. I got a personal story myself. It was a friend of mine I went to school with. His father went into cardiac arrest coming down Broad Street, hit 13 different cars, started CPR on them right there at Broad Street. He survived.
Yeah.
His granddaughter come to see me, and she didn't know my relationship with her uncles that I went to school with them and knew their granddad too. So it's a pretty neat little story.
You know, I remember a number of years back, probably as far back as when I was in high school, I would hear over here some nurses jokingly say, you know, if you see me pass out and die, don't do CPR on me because I don't want to come back with brain damage because yes. It's just going to ruin my life. But you don't even hear that anymore because of the fact that you've got these new methods of doing things, so it prevents the brain damage. And with the Lucas device as an example, I'm sure, like you were saying, you've seen stories where people walk into the fire station a day or two later after getting CPR.
We have. It's happening more often now, and the key to it's that quick response time and getting the medical treatment they need right away. Because normally, something that causes you to have a heart attack is something that could be fixed.
Yeah.
But after it happens, you know, it's too late to fix it right then. Now you're in dying mode. So if we can save you, get to that, to the ER and get that fixed, you know.
I guess there's a lot of different factors there. It could be cardiac arrest because of some type of a trauma that happened, or it could be cardiac arrest because your heart is maybe 95 years old and it just went out.
You know, and you're saying 95, age has a big factor on it. Of course, the younger the person is, the better chance they're going to have. But yes, it's really changed over the last years. We're starting to see a whole lot more survival rate from it. And as a matter of fact, we're working on some software right now. It's kind of hard to track because when we have a medical call like this, if it stays local, we can find out maybe through the hospital if they made it or not, or if they come back. But we're trying to start tracking so we can say we started CPR and this is how many people we saved. Right now, the software is kind of hard to do that because we ship the patient off to the hospital and we don't have those updates like we would like to have.
What's so great about that is I have a feeling that would be really life-changing for the firefighters as well to know, hey, I saved this life. They're doing better now.
Yes. You know, a lot of times they come back and thank the firemen and the EMS staff that did it for them. And you can tell the guys and girls, they feel good about themselves, what they've done. I remember one of the calls where they had brought the gentleman back and he was living to come back to see the guys at the station. And our chaplain happened to be there. And the mother was thanking him because at the call, she said, I don't know what to do. And he said, the best you can do right now is pray. And he said, well, you pray for me. So our chaplain that was on the call was with the wife. They're over in another room praying. And of course, he survived. It was just a neat story to see her tell him that and them doing that together and him walking back into the fire station and thanking them for it. And,
pretty cool.
Yeah.
Murfreesboro Fire Chief Mark McCluskey with us today. Well, thank you for joining us.
Yes, sir. Appreciate it. Enjoyed it.
This is WGNS Action Line.
FM 101.9, FM 100.5, AM 1450, and online at WGNSradio.com.
Here at Animal City, we're not just about the dogs and cats. We also have an expansive small animal department with all of the supplies your guinea pig, rabbit, hedgehog, sugar glider, or more would want. Hi, this is Amanda from Animal City, inviting your family to come do business with my family. When you come to see us, don't forget to stop downstairs. That's where you'll find our small animal department filled with all of your small pets' desires. Animal City's open 10 to 6 Monday through Saturday and 1 to 5 on Sunday.
What I like to think about Adam's Place is it's sort of a pipeline.
Alan Butcher.
You enter in at the independent living end of it and you go as far as you can. It It just happens that my wife is in the memory unit, so I'm able to go over and see her each day, and that works out real well.
Hi, this is Terry Deal at Adams Place. Call me for more information about Adams Place. Phone 615-904-9111.
Adams Place on Memorial, across from Walmart.